Sorry for all these technical problems. I'd like to thank Jorge for inviting me to give this talk. So this is based on work I've been doing recently with Miguel Cantiglia and Abhay Ashkar, looking for path integral representations of loop quantum cosmology. So we can go to the first slide. I'd like to change the wording of this first sentence. Upon reading it, it may be misleading. The point I wanted to make is that there have been heuristic arguments against singularity resolution and a general theory of quantum gravity using path integrals. These are based on a naive path integral that's just the integral over the space's metrics of EZI Einstein-Hilbert action. The basic argument is that quantum corrections should be small if the action evaluated along these classical solutions is very large compared to H-bar. And in the case of the FRW metric, you know, this is the case. The action will diverge if evaluated along that metric. So we expect that the quantum corrections to that singular solution would be small, and the singularity can't be resolved. I want to stress that these are based on kind of a naive path integral that has no input from the canonical theory, and also these are fairly heuristic arguments. And so we know that the singularity in LQC is resolved, and the resolution is robust. So what we wondered is what happens to the path integral to change these arguments? Like, where do these break down? So our second motivation comes from wanting to make some connection to spin film models. There's been a number of recent developments in spin films that have allowed for the construction of new models that are more closely related to the canonical quantum theory, including the Friedel-Krasnov model and the Engel, Levine, Pereira, and Rovelli model. So it's important then to also construct path integrals coming from the canonical theory when possible to make connections in that direction as well, especially because there's a hope that spin films will help us define the physical inner products of the canonical theory, and also the canonical theory can help motivate and define the measures, et cetera, used in spin films. So there can be a lot of benefits from making connections across the two. And so our third motivation is to use a path integral representation of LQC to do physics in LQC and the more complicated models of LQC. Basically, using the path integral techniques, we can possibly argue for why the effective equations used to approximate the quantum dynamics are so surprisingly accurate in more complex models like the K equal 1, non-zero cosmological constant, and say like the Bianchi 1 models. And further, we can use standard methods to try to compute loop corrections to the action. So those are our motivations. So we can go on to the next slide. So for a brief introduction, what we're going to do here is construct a path integral for the exactly soluble loop quantum cosmology, starting from the canonical quantization. So basically, we go back to the original path integral construction done by Feynman, and follow those kind of standard technique. And so this construction will define each component of the path integral, including the space of paths, the measure, and the phase of each path appearing in the path integral. And so each will have really non-trivial changes from the naive path integral that one would write down. And further from this path integral, we'll be able to see the origin of singularity resolution, which really arises due to changes to both the space of paths and to a change in the action appearing in the path integral. And so we'll see that the structure of this path integral has some similarity to spin films, which I'll try to point out. And finally, we will give an argument for the surprising accuracy of the effective equations used to approximate the quantum dynamics. So the next slide, we have an outline. I want to overview the standard construction of path integrals just in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, so then we know what the procedure is going to be. I'll review important aspects of the exactly soluble LQC model, and then construct the LQC path integral using the techniques from the first part. I'll look at other forms of the path integral, basically trying to get down to a configuration space form. And then look at the issues of singularity resolution from the path integral and also the effective equations. And then there'll be a conclusion. So going to the next slide, just a brief discussion of, you know, what path integrals are in general. They're basically an equivalent formulation of quantum theory expressed as a sum over paths. Formally, we could write the path integrals in the form of equation 1. It's the integral over, the space of all paths in configuration space with some measure of e to the I s over h bar, or as an integral over all paths in phase space. And to define a path integral directly from the classical theory without passing through the canonical theory involves defining the components of these formal expressions, including what is the space of paths over which we should be integrating. Should these be continuous paths, differentiable paths? What is the measure on the space of paths, which is one of the more non-trivial things to input? And what is S here? What is the phase associated to each path? And here I denote it as S because it typically will be the classical action. And so each of these components can be determined by constructing the path angle from the canonical theory when it's possible. And so that's what we intend to do. So going to the next slide, here I'm going to overview the standard construction of path integrals for non-relativistic quantum mechanics. I apologize ahead of time for those of you who are already well familiar with this. Just please bear with me for the next 5 slides. I feel like it's important to define the techniques here in a simple case so that we can then extend them to LQC. So basically what we want is a path integral representation of the propagator in equation 2, which is equivalently the matrix elements of e to the minus I Hamiltonian delta t over h bar. And so the first step is to split this exponential into n identical terms, into e to the minus I Hamiltonian epsilon over h bar, where we define this epsilon to be the delta t over n, the number of terms in the product. And the smallness of this parameter is critical for many of the following steps. So the smallness and the limit then goes to infinity. The second, we insert a complete basis of x between each exponential. And going to the next slide, this by defining xn to be the final position and x0 to be the initial position, this simplifies to just a product over n propagators from, say, x0 to x1, x1 to x2, etc., with integrals over all of the intermediate points. And so right now, it's not really that useful, but in the limit n goes to infinity, we can expand each term in this product, these kind of infinitesimal propagators, to first order an epsilon and compute them. So here we're making use of the smallness of this parameter and the limit. And so this can be written as an integral, as in equation 7, as an integral over momentum, where the function h appearing here is just some discretization of the Hamiltonian. And that will depend on exactly what our factor ordering is and other issues. So going on to the next slide, we can insert the propagator that we calculated previously back into the full expression and simplifying. And we see that in the top part, we have what will basically be the measure on our space of paths, which is the limit as n goes to infinity of n minus 1 integrals over position and all n integrals over momenta. And basically, in the limit, this is going to be an integral over each position at times between t prime and t. At t prime and t, the endians are fixed to be the initial and final positions, and integral over the momentum at all times. In the bottom half, we see the first term already looks like the discretization of e to the I px dot, and the second term here is an infinite product over basically 1 minus I epsilon with the Hamiltonian evaluated at each n. And so this is almost in a path integral form, except for this final product. So we'll digress briefly into looking at these products, partially because I like infinite products in series. So we see the infinite product has the form of equation 9. Just the limit n goes to infinity of a product of 1 plus an times epsilon plus higher order terms, where an is some sequence. And so if an is constant for all n, in this we recall from intro calculus, this just reduces to a very simple case, the limit n goes to infinity of this 1 plus a epsilon plus higher order terms to the n just goes to the exponential e to the a delta t. And this can be generalized if the sequence is not all the same, which means you can see in equation 11 that this product is equal to the limit of the exponential of the sum of a n times epsilon. And this actually holds for fairly general sequences. There's technical issues that we won't really worry about. And so we can extend this product to the property we had on the previous slide and write this limit of the 1 minus I epsilon Hamiltonian as an exponential of the sum of those terms. And so this allows us to arrive at the final result on the next slide, where combining all these results together, we finally have the propagator expressed as a phase-based path integral. So in the top part of equation 13, we have the same measure we had previously. And this is now integrals over e to the I over h bar s, which depends on x, all the x's p's, and also this large n. And we'll recognize s here as the discretized action in equation 14. And you can see very clearly, if you take the limit and goes to infinity, that this will approach the actual action. So it's just integral dt of px dot minus the Hamiltonian. And so we arrive at really the final construction by going through this canonical procedure, which is to find the space of paths, the measure on those space of paths, and the action. So going to the next slide, I just want to overview the strategy. This is really the only important thing to take from these slides is just what is the overall idea of how to construct this. Basically, we start from the propagator, written in terms of the matrix elements of the unitary operator that generates our time evolution. We split this into we split that exponential into n copies, basically introducing the small parameter epsilon. We insert a complete basis between each exponential, and then evaluate each of the resulting terms to first order epsilon, and then just re-exponentiate the resulting expression to get the final path integral. And from here, one can try to integrate out momenta to obtain a configuration space path integral if possible. So that concludes just the basic construction. So if there are any questions here, I'll pause. Otherwise, we'll go on to the next slide. So here, just to overview some of the important elements of the exactly soluble LQC model, this is a model that was discussed in a paper by Ashokar, Karichi, and Singh. Basically, it's a simplification of the k equals 0 FRW model that allows it to be solved exactly analytically. And so we notice it's the quantum theory is expressed very simply in terms of these B nu variables, which are written in equation 16. Where nu here is proportional to the volume, and B is its conjugate, the conjugate variable. And they have a Poisson bracket here, which is given by 2 over h bar, where the h bar appears because of the Planck length in nu here. And so classically, these are going to have range from minus infinity to infinity. And that's basically arising because of there's an orientation factor appearing in both these terms, being this other epsilon. And so the thing that makes this model exactly soluble is basically choose the lattice to be proportional to the volume, or proportional to a cubed. And FOQC, I think the n prime is actually chosen to be 1. But this allows a simplification of the Hamiltonian constraint. And so with these choices, the phase space action for FRW just takes the form of equation 18. So we have B dot nu h bar over 2 plus the scalar field term minus n prime over 2 times our constraint. Going to the next slide, we can try to construct a path integral directly from this classical theory, just by trying to extrapolate from the final result we had from the non-relativistic case. So we'd expect something in the form of equation 19. We have some propagator of, between nu t and nu prime t prime, expressed as an integral over probably b, nu, probably maybe p phi, phi, laps, b to the I action appearing on the previous slide. So here we'd allow the paths in b and nu to range over all reals, just because that's what they could be classically. And so for those of you who know, this is somewhat more difficult than the non-relativistic case because it's a reparameterization invariant and constrained theory. So it's not non-trivial to actually write down the path integral. And so the action, we can find that the action is evaluated along the classical path between, say, nu and nu prime. And it's given equation 20 here. where you can see that as either new or new prime approach zero, approach singularity, this is going to diverge. And even the factor out front will typically be fairly large in units of h bar as well. And so we'd expect, that due to this argument, that the quantum corrections are negligible if the classical action is very large in units of h bar, that there should be minimal quantum corrections to this to these singular paths, which would seem like it's saying that there's no bounce. And so again, I want to stress this is, you know, this is kind of just a heuristic path integral trying to extrapolate from the what we learned from the non-relativistic case. And we really have to see what happens if we construct a path integral directly from the canonical theory. And we'll see that really what's going to happen is that both the space of paths will change dramatically, the action, and the measure. And so that'll tell us where this argument really breaks down. So going to the next slide, just discuss some of the important features of the quantization. So we're going to construct the path integral from the physical Hilbert space of SLQC. And just recall some of the thoughts on the fly. But yes?
I have a question there. I mean, so far you presented it's Laurent Fredel on the phone. You presented the path integral for usual gravity, right?
Mm-hmm.
The question of gravity. But then you could take the point of view. Let me take this point of view that LQC is just some type of discretization. The
fact
that I've replaced the classical Hamiltonian p squared plus v by sine p squared plus v.
Right.
Then I have this Hamiltonian, and then I have a corresponding classical action that describes the classical dynamics. And then the guy that will enter the path integral will be this classical action. So the classical action that you wrote two slides before should be modified by replacing, I think, nu by sine sinus of nu or something like that.
Right, and this we'll see is possible. But also we'll see that actually the space of paths themselves will be changed as well. And in LQC it's possible to actually write the path integral as they integrals over basically space of paths and b nu that can range over minus infinity to infinity with this modified action with sine squared lambda b. And in this case, this argument does change, and we see the path integral peaks along the bouncing solution. So that's exactly right.
Yeah, because the classical action of LQC is this modified action.
So I think the point that Adam is making is that what you say is something that will be sort of heuristically what one might expect. But can we just follow Feynman and Higgs, start with quantum mechanics, and actually derive the path integral and see what we get? That's what he's trying to do.
Yeah, but I don't see why you say it's heuristic. What I'm just saying here is that if I take a different Hamiltonian and different classical action, which is different from the usual one, then Feynman-Hibbs is a generic procedure to get the Feynman path integral for given a classical action. So
it is a general thing. So why that it is the standard thing. If in fact you are a representation, I mean, if you started Feynman-Hibbs started with quantum mechanics, and that in that quantum mechanics. One just has square integral functions. It was Schrodinger representation, square integral functions of x's, etc. And if I did that, I get the standard path integral. In loop quantum cosmology and loop quantum gravity, we do not have the standard representation in the quantum theory.
You have periodic. I mean, okay, we can discuss that. But you have, yeah. I mean, people have asked.
I think what you're saying is essentially right. The question is of actually.
Yeah.
We would like to show that, right, from first principles. That,
okay.
And furthermore, as Adam just said, we also have to change the space of paths. So we would just like to get it more systematically. So finally, somebody like you who has thought about it would not be surprised by the results.
Okay.
But one would like to sort of arrive at those results in a very systematic way, allow Feynman and Hibbs, starting the canonical theory, which we already know.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that in some sense, I mean, maybe. Do you think the subtlety here lies in the sets of configuration space? So it has been true that people have developed Feynman path integral where the configuration space is periodic. But in your case, in LQC, it looks like the momentum space, in fact, you know, is periodic. And that's very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But okay.
All right. So going on to the next slide, well, I guess the slide we already had us all go to. So we'll construct this path integral from the physical Hilbert space of SLQC. And so as Abhay mentioned, I mean, the important thing is that there's really a different kinematical structure to the Hilbert space we're working with. namely that there's really a discreteness to the inner product in terms of nu. And so the physical solutions, the physical states here are solutions to the quantum Hamiltonian constraint given in equation 21, where this theta hat operator is a discrete difference operator, which will, you know, it shifts, one term shifts nu to nu plus 4, one shifts nu to nu minus 4 with some multiplicative factors. And so we can attain the physical Hilbert space by a group averaging procedure. And just picking the positive frequency part, we find that physical states satisfy a Schrödinger-like equation, given equation 22, where now phi is playing the role of a time, and this square root theta operator is playing the role of our Hamiltonian. And so on the physical Hilbert states, we have the inner product in equation 23, where this is really we see it is given as a discrete sum over 4 and lambda of 1 over nu, basically psi star psi. And in this case, it's only our newest 4 lambda because this theta operator just picks out a fixed lattice, an invariant lattice in nu. So this is the important aspects of the physical Hilbert space. Going to the next slide, we have SOQC written in the form of a Schrödinger equation with phi at the time. So apply the same construction we did in the non-relativistic case to the system. And so similar to the construction in that case, we want a half-angle representation of the propagator in equation 24, where now it's the matrix elements of e to the I root theta delta phi. And so more generally, we really want to construct this from the physical inner product in terms of the group, written in terms of group, the group averaging procedure, because in general, phi will not be available, there will not be a natural time variable available. And so that's something we're currently looking at. So next slide, please. So to follow the same steps we did in the non-relativistic case, first we have some knowledge of the exact propagator here. So one can show that the propagator is zero if nu prime is less than zero and nu is greater than zero. Basically just because if we by repeated actions of theta, we can't get from a positive nu to a negative nu, because if we end up at zero, it will just get a zero as a result. And so this allows us to simplify the calculation dramatically by just restricting to either positive or negative nu. Basically, we can get rid of a lot of absolute values, which will make things more complicated. And so also, we can find an exact expression for this in terms of an integral over b, basically because this is an exactly followable model. And I think there's some factors of 3 pi and g missing somewhere here. But it's written as this very complicated integral over b. So at least we have something to compare to. We just want to compare to an exact result. So going to the next slide, now we'll begin the construction. So as before, we'll split this exponential into n copies and insert a complete basis of nu between each of these. In this case, this complete basis has changed. Now it's a discrete sum over nu. It's 4 and lambda with this absolute value of nu appearing here. And also, just recall here that lambda is related to the minimal area eigenvalue of Lupin gravity. And so this will give us equation 28, which is still is basically a product of n propagators with sums over all of the intermediate points. But you know, the important difference here is that instead of continuous integrals over x, we now have these discrete sums over nu. And so the next step would be to compute each term of this product, or these infinitesimal propagators, given equation 29. Going to the next slide, we can try to do this. The problem here is that even to compute this to first order epsilon requires really knowledge of the full spectrum of theta in order to define what the square root of theta is. And so the resolution is basically to rewrite each term as in equation 31. The integral over dn and integral over p phi will, the integral dn will give us a delta function, and the integral over p phi will restrict p phi to be root theta. And basically what we're doing here with hindsight is just kind of backtracking some of the steps in the group averaging procedure to arrive back at an integral dn of e to the I constraint. And so we then only need to evaluate the following term, the first order epsilon, the one that actually depends on theta. For now, this is just a nice polynomial in theta, so it's fairly easy to evaluate. towards the next slide, we can evaluate this term in equation 33. The interesting thing here is that the it turns out just to be a delta function minus I epsilon just times some function of nu times the sum of delta functions. So you'd expect it to be each delta function would have its own coefficient, but they kind of group nicely, all the same coefficient. And this can be expressed as an integral by writing each delta function as an integral over b, as given equation 34. So this is similar to what happened in the non-relativistic case, where we inserted integrals over p at this point. And so, as Ronald said, we can already see that we expected b. We now have finally lambda b over lambda here. So going to the next slide. Basically, if we plug this back into our full expression for the propagator, we end up with an infinite product, which we could then re-exponentiate using this kind of trick with the product, and arrive at the final expression for the path integral. In this case, in the first line, we have basically product of n discrete sums over nu, n minus 1 discrete sums over nu, n integrals over b, only from 0 to pi over lambda, and also integrals over p phi and n. So this really is the path integral over nu, b, the scalar field momentum, and lapse. And this is these are integrals of this exponential term below that, which we recognize as e to the I or h bar times some discretized action. And that discretized action is given in equation 36. Where here, this is in this case, it's really an integral over d phi because we've chosen phi to be our time. Otherwise, the only major change is just going from this b squared to sine squared lambda b over lambda. But otherwise, we see that there are really non-trivial changes to the space of paths, the measure, and the action here, which I'll discuss in the following slides. We can go on to the next slide. Here we'll discuss what are the allowed paths in B and nu of the path integral. These are really defined by what is what the range of integration is at each time phi. And so the paths v phi here have to be discrete because v phi is allowed to be multiples of 4 lambda. So it's going to be 4 lambda, 8 lambda, 12 lambda. So there'll be some sequence of kind of step functions of just size 4 lambda or some multiple 4 lambda. And then the paths b phi are still continuous, but they're going to be bounded. So the b has to lie between 0 and pi over lambda. So this is a fairly large change from what we would have expected, being that the paths in nu and b would be allowed to range from minus infinity to infinity. And so basically what's happened here, they seem to be integrating only over discrete quantum geometries, or that the canonical theory has really told us what paths we can integrate over. And this is similar to the situation that occurs in spin films, where one would think to try to start out and integrate over continuous fields of the tetrahedron connection, but really we're looking at integrating over discrete geometries given by like triangulations and the spin labels. So here the space of paths has been modified due to the kinematical structure of LQC and also the dynamics. And also, the measure has changed here, but it's still fairly a natural measure on the space of paths. It's a fairly trivial measure, but it's really changed dramatically because of the space of paths has changed. So, for the next slide, we see also, the phase of this action has also changed quite a bit from the our expectation. It is not the classical action. It's really a discretized version of an effective action, which contains these non-perturbative quantum corrections, which you see in equation 38. And so this is the action that one would use to generate effective equations that would well approximate the quantum dynamics. So there's been an input from the canonical theory into what the action is as well. So going to the next slide. I guess that is the end of me just of the construction. So are there any questions there?
Okay.
Yes, I mean, the action could be expected just be, if we say that the... So the question is, could the action be expected just from some general principles? And I would say, yes, I mean, we know that the holonomy doesn't have... I mean, basically, in LQG, the holonomy doesn't have an operator. So we should really be working in terms of the connection that doesn't have an operator corresponding to it. So we should really be working in terms of holonomies. So we should be expressing the action in terms of functions of holonomies. And so in this case, what we're seeing is the replacement of B with some suitable regularization in terms of holonomies. So in more complex models, we could do similar things. And so what we want to do now is try to simplify this path integral and try to obtain possibly a configuration space representation. And so in this case, we can see that it's possible to integrate out N and P phi in exact same way that I introduced them. The integral over N gives a delta function. The integral over P phi just it basically imposes that delta function. And we arrive at the expression equation 39, which is basically equivalent to just solving the constraint. So here we have a path integral just on the constraint surface. And here we can see that the first term in the exponential would basically be a discretization of square root theta. Going to the next slide.
But maybe it would be clarified to go back to the previous slide, equation 38, no?
38, yes.
So because 38 is you have a classical action here, which I think this is also why you have partly there's several things in your derivation. There's the discretization, but there's also the appearance of this action. This action is really the classical action of LQC, right? The 38.
I don't know what you mean by classical. So
I mean that in LQC you have an Hamiltonian which
is
P squared plus some potential. So if I treat this Hamiltonian as a classical Hamiltonian, it has a classical action, which is this one. And this is not...
I just want to say that this is a confusing point, that's why. I mean, as you can see from the slide equation 38, there is an explicit H-bar in it.
Well, the thing is that in LQC, there's two parameters. There's one parameter of discretization, and then one H-bar. Now, you can decide, and usually LQC, you decide that the parameter of discretization is also proportional to H-bar. But for a moment, let me free myself from that. In general, what I have is these two parameters, and I can take two limits. One limit, which is the continuum limit, where I replace sine p squared by p squared, and one which is the classical limit, where I just look at my Hamiltonian as a classical Hamiltonian. And then this classical Hamiltonian as an action, it turns out that an extra assumption in LQC is that this discretization parameter is also dependent on H-bar, but it doesn't carry the same rule. So in that sense, you see, in terms of you can embed LQC in a bigger system which has Hamiltonian, which is sine p squared plus potential, and there are two parameters, h bar and the discretization parameter. The fact that you want to take one proportional to the other is a further restriction, but it doesn't it doesn't touch really this embedding. You see what I'm getting?
I think spiritually, morally, I think I agree with you, but technically I don't, in the sense that really the discretization parameter here is lambda.
Well, because you decided to do so, but it doesn't change that the quantization of the theory and the classical limit of the theory are in this sense different things. I mean, it's not something I've discovered. For me, it was the first time I learned that was from Jorge in the company. But I think it's a very clarifying point.
But I still want to say that there is both h bar and lambda here. And lambda is the discretization parameter. But again, as you say, conceptually or spiritually, what you say is true. But technically, there are several differences. First of all, the equation one uses is very important that there was a square root there, right? Square root of theta. And so it's a mixture of what you call Feynman-Hibbs type Hamiltonian with p squared plus a potential. It's not really that. It's something more like what the situation is for a free relativistic particle, not a non-relativistic particle. And in addition to that, I really want to say that technically you have to keep careful track of the two different parameters. One is what you call the discretization parameter, I agree, which really is lambda, and then there is this quantization H-bar. and the two are not the same. I mean, we can divorce them, but they both appear in action. Just want to say that.
I'm just saying that, I mean, if we start from a model which is, maybe we should let him finish, but if we start from a model which is P, as a Hamiltonian constraint, P squared plus Q squared, then we can do a modification which is like sine Gordon, P squared plus sine Q squared, or we do a modification which is sine P squared plus Q squared. And we can all treat this model as classical model. Now, I understand that in your model, you want the discretization parameter lambda to be whatever, I mean, to be, you know, not independent from H bar, but that's an extra step, which there's no, you could treat AQC on some, or, you know, you could embed AQC into more general theory where you say, well, let me look at the quantization where I also discretize the volume with some other parameter, which is not related to H bar. And you know, and you would get the same singularity avoidance and the same phenomenology. That's not what you want to do, but it's a further restriction on something more general that the model is embedded into. That's okay, maybe.
What is justification
in H-bar? So it mostly comes from, the question is why is there an H-bar in front of nu, and why don't we just absorb it into it so the action looks more classical? And the reason these variables are chosen such that they simplify the quantum theory. So going to the next slide here, well, actually, I think I guess going to the slide of the configuration space path integral, or which is some related to spin film models.
Which equation number?
Equation number 40.
Hello?
Yes?
Maybe I should ask a question at this stage, otherwise we'll go into some other details. So it's coming back to equation 38.
Yes.
So my question is that, have you guys thought about how one can also, or maybe can one capture the kind of terms which Victor derived for the same model?
Yes, I mean there's standard techniques and path integrals to construct like the loop corrections to this action, which we haven't done yet, but yeah, we definitely thought about doing that.
Okay. So using the same method, one can try to derive the extra terms in the quantum corrections to the Friedman equation.
That's one of the things that we're interested in doing is actually computing these higher corrections to these kind of like the perturbative corrections to this action for the path integral.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so back at equation 40, we can further integrate out B here to obtain basically a form of the property that looks like in equation 40, which is a limit as n goes to infinity of a sum over sequences of nu of some amplitude. And this is what makes it look very similar to a spin foam type model. Because the sigma n here is just some sequence of nu's of length n, starting with the initial nu and ending at nu prime. And a sigma here is some amplitude associated to each of these sequences, which will be a product of vertex amplitudes, we'll just call them. And these depend only on the nu at the n minus 1 step and the nu at the n step. So they really depend on the vertices between these nu's. And so the vertex amplitudes here we can actually compute. And they're roughly given by equation 42. This is actually just the real part. There's an imaginary part here as well. But they're roughly given just by Bessel functions, which is kind of interesting. And so actually here this nu n minus 2 n minus 1 over 2 lambda is an integer. So there's the integer Bessel functions. This is a function here of epsilon being the delta phi over n, and also of the volumes. And so it's interesting to see the similarity here, that we do see this ends up being a sum over amplitudes of these discrete paths in nu with the amplitudes really given as a product of these vertex amplitudes. So this is kind of the final form we can get it down to in terms of a configuration state path integral. We can equally attempt to sum over nu, which is somewhat more difficult because it's a sum, and less known about sums and intervals, of course. So going on to the next slide, we can discuss where singularity resolution arises in this from this path integral. In this case, it's easiest to really go back to the path integral over nu, b, p fine, n, just because it's less complicated to work with than the previous two simplifications or that's the previous two forms. So here we can see that the path integral is really, it's no longer dominated by these classical singular solutions. The classical singular solutions are not even in the space of paths that we're integrating over. Classically, B will diverge the singularity, whereas here the paths B and phi are bounded, so that path is not in the space of paths that we're integrating. And further, very simply, I mean we have a minimum nu, which is 4 lambda. So again, we're not going to have any approach to nu equals 0. So for very simple reasons, the classical singular paths are not in the space of paths that we integrate over. And further, the action appearing in the path integral is not the classical action. So there are different classical paths, or different solutions to that action that will contribute to the path integral. And so the singularity resolution here seems to arise due to both the restriction to discrete geometries and to the effective action appearing in the path integral. And we can actually see this due primarily to the effective action, as we discussed previously in the next slide. Basically, here, we can actually replace these discrete sums over nu, integrals over b, with just continuous integrals over nu and b. So this is a trick that can be done equivalently in the particle on a circle in non-relative to quantum mechanics. We can replace all the integrals over b and nu except for one integral that remains over b that's still just between 0 and pi over lambda. But this transforms basically the space of paths and the measure almost entirely to those of just the standard kind of the standard path integral. So then the only change we have is just the action. And in general, this most likely won't be possible. I mean, this is really coming from the nice form of the path integral. So it may not be possible in more complex cases, like to say Bianchi 1. And it's definitely difficult to see how this could work in the full theory of Lupin gravity. So the only change we have is just this the action appearing here. Going to the next slide. So we then say that this path integral is most likely dominated by the extreme of this effective action, whose classical solutions, which I just call x effective here, are the bouncing solutions that really well approximate the quantum dynamics. And we can compute the action along these bouncing solutions, say between nu and nu prime, say possibly between like the minimum volume and 10 times minimum volume, or something like this. And for these, we see that S effective is large. The effective action evaluated along these solutions is large units of H bar. So this gives a reason also why these loop corrections are negligible. So A tells us that the path integral is most likely dominated by these effective solutions, and that the higher order quantum corrections will be negligible. So the quantum evolution should very closely follow these bouncing solutions that feature the singularity resolution. And so this provides an initial explanation for the accuracy of the effective equations as well, which we'll try to generalize to more complex models. And so this is basically we're applying the exact same argument that was applied to say why singularity resolution won't happen in terms of path integrals to hear that this argument is changed into why the singularity is resolved and also why there are small quantum corrections to those paths. Going to the next slide, we want to try to generalize this to more complex loop quantum cosmology models. Many of the results here, especially the construction, can be generalized to the more complicated cases, like the k equals 1 and the non-zero cosmological constant, and even possibly the Bianchi 1 and non-isotropic models. And for these models, we also have effective equations, which really surprisingly approximate very well the quantum dynamics. But this accuracy is really not well understood in these more complex cases because we don't have like exact analytic solutions as we have in the k equals zero model. And also the assumptions that are used to derive these effect equations, which you know from geometric quantum mechanics done by Willis and Victor Tavares, the assumptions fail in the high curvature region. So exactly where we want to know why these equations are so accurate is where the assumptions that generated them fail. So we really want to try to extend this path integral argument from the k equals zero case. And basically it would be that we expect that the action appearing in the path integral is going to be the effective actions that generate these effective equations used to approximate the quantum dynamics. And further, that these actions evaluate along its classical solutions, or along these bouncing solutions, will be large in the units of h-bar. So the loop corrections are negligible. That's the basic argument, is that the action we find should be the effective action, which gives the effective equations for these models, and that the action evaluated along these solutions will be large. So the quantum dynamics should very closely follow the solution to these effective equations. And so that's the hope for getting a real reason why these effective equations are so surprisingly accurate. And this would be very useful, especially in Bianchi 1 case, where we don't yet have a numerical simulation to compare effective equations to. So that it gives a way to actually trust the effective equations without having the numerical simulations to back them up. So that concludes my main points I want to make. So if there are any questions about the past few slides, I'd like them now. Otherwise, we can go on to the conclusions here. Next slide. Basically, what we've done here is construct a path integral representation for the exactly soluble LQC model, starting from the conceptual quantization. We see that really due to the chemical structure of LQC, the paths integrated over are these discrete quantum geometries, where nu is restricted to be the paths in nu restricted are these discrete paths, and the paths in B are bounded. And this is similar to the spin film models. So we found that we can write the path integral as a sum over sequences of nu with amplitudes for each sequence given by a product of these like vertex amplitudes. Further, the modified action appearing in the path integral has these bouncing solutions as its classical solutions, which provides an argument for the singularity resolution from the path integral representation. And further, we provide an argument for how the path integral representation of the more complicated LQC models may provide an argument for the surprising accuracy of their effective equations. And just so for future work, we're really interested in looking at constructing the path integral for some of these more complex models, seeing what the action is, and also exactly what Prom said, is to try to compute some of the corrections to this action and see if we can get the same corrections as Victor has gotten for the k equals zero case. And that is all. So thank you.
Questions?
Hello?
Yes?
Actually, I would like to understand what are the key ingredients to repeat this recipe from the loop quantization side. So I would like to understand what is actually the key element. So do we need inner product? Like I'm thinking more of if you want to apply to more general models, like let us say going beyond even Bianchi 1 or k equal to 1 model, but let us say something like massive scalar field in LQC.
Yes, actually we're looking at how it's constructing this in terms of from the definition of physical products and group averaging. So just looking at this as really starting from the group averaging procedure and being able to write this projector basically as expanding that in terms of a path integral. So right now actually Miguel and I are looking at that. So far for this construction we really would require kind of a going down to a Schrodinger type form just to follow through the construction. But I think that it can definitely be be generalized to cases where there isn't a time.
Yeah, so that's where I was coming to. So do you really need some notion of a global internal clock, or you can, so for example, for the massive scalar field case, at least one can define the clock locally. So that's the first point. The second point is, do we really need to work with the Schrodinger-like equation, or?
Yeah, in this case, I don't think we do. I think that this can definitely be generalized to just looking at it in terms of group averaging.
Okay.
It's very nice to construct it from the Schrodinger form, because that's the form that we're very familiar with.
I have a question. In fact, I would like to go back to the equation 45. It's a question concerning the appearance of H bar in the action, because it seems this is a key point.
Okay.
Yeah, if we look at 45, I think the meaning is that here there is a H bar appearing in the action, but it's also appearing H bar B, U bar. So suppose I redefine a variable that I define Q, which is H bar times mu.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, H bar will disappear completely from the action. And then if I study just this model as a classical model and its quantification, this is really the model I was talking about. Now, for the physical interpretation, it might be important because I guess mu is a volume here. It has a dimension of a volume.
It has dimensions of actually length, because mu involves 1/Planck-Planck². So mu actually has an H bar in it, basically.
Oh, so mu already has an H bar in it. So what?
Yeah.
So if I multiply by H bar, then I get the H bar I put in mu.
Yeah. So
if I take these variables where I don't put H bar, then it doesn't appear in the action.
Yeah. Laura, you're right. That one can redefine mu.
Okay.
The way it was defined was just in order to make the calculation simpler in the whole case. You know, it was little like the way we define creation and an election operator for harmonic oscillator.
Yes.
H bar in it. So I think one can redefine nu. But it is, even if you redefine nu, the new nu, that is to say H bar times the current nu, would not be quite a volume. So there is...
Yeah, that I appreciate it. That for the physical interpretation, it's important to go back.
Exactly.
But for I'm looking just as a mathematical model of.
Yes.
Okay.
All I was saying before was not really disagreeing with you in anything. It is just that your intuition was completely what is worn out, as you can see at the end of the talk.
Yeah.
The question was, to me at least, to all of us, all three of us working here, that there were several things which are different from Feynman and Hibbs. The Hamiltonian constraint, even the constraint, is not just p squared, but there's also sort of connection in it. It's like c squared p squared. So you know, there's a part of the connection in it. It's not clean momentum squared. And there's also square root. And most, to me, the most important thing was that Feynman and Hibbs really used very strongly things like the fact that they were working with Schrodinger representation. And the Hamiltonian has the form p squared upon 2n plus v, whereas here we are not in the Schrodinger representation. And do any of these things change, the one sort of first instinctive conclusion? And the answer is that yes, but only mildly, namely that you have to be careful about what parts you integrate over. But finally, the action that you get, the action which determines the phase in the particle is indeed the effective action, as you're saying.
Yes. I agree that there's a subtlety as was pointed out, which is that, you know, I think the good analogy is the one that you pointed out in your conclusion, which is like the particle on the circle, right? Except that here the circle is the momentum, so that's,
yeah, right.
You know, very new. That's
yes.
I hope it was. I mean, I didn't mean to say it was trivial. I meant to. It was for me. It was a clarification.
Yeah, I think it is a clarification. That is the point of view. But again, you know, it makes some contact also with spin forms. Hopefully,
yes.
You know, like this vertex amplitudes, etc., that are coming up here. Mm-hmm. So maybe one can make more progress on that side. So from point of view future, that is what is more promising. And also this idea that I think Adam has been very careful here, but. If I look at the cosmological constant and k equal to 1 models, at least to me it was not clear up to now why the effective equations are so good approximations to the exact quantum evolution. And the analysis here that has already been done actually does explain why that is the case. So there are a few clarifications that occur. Kirill has a question.
Hi, this is Vikar.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I have a comment especially regarding Abhay's comments. I just wanted to mention that around 2003 I'd written a draft which never got circulated, which makes some of the same points about starting from a path integral that begins with polymer quantization. So I can circulate that to you after.
Okay, that'd be great. Thank you.
This is Kirill. I have a question. So the question is, can I think about this classical action as coming from some action of the type we're used to when we consider renormalization of gravity, so action with higher order curvature invariance added to Einstein-Hilbert action, and then symmetry reduction applied to it. So can it be thought of something like expanding the sine function into power series, and then thinking of every term in that power series as coming from some higher order in curvature invariant?
Yeah, in a sense, I think we could. I mean, yeah, because this is going to be this assigned into the series in B. I haven't actually looked at exactly how this B would relate to.
I think Param has written a paper on this, so maybe Param, you can comment on this.
But actually, like as far as I understand, I don't think it can be written in a invariant form. So, like one can take this Hamiltonian, and if one tries to write just as in a metric theory, as a higher curvature, as any arbitrary combination of the higher curvature terms, like my understanding is that one, it cannot describe the whole behavior till the bound. So one has to do something like the Pelletini theory or some non-metric theory. And actually, we wrote down an action in the Pelletini F of R theory, but it can be generalized to more arbitrary forms of curvature invariant. But as far as I believe, it cannot be done in the pure metric form.
What are the type of invariants that arise?
Sorry?
What are the type of invariants that arise?
So the way it put down so far was a general f of r function, where r is in Pelletini. So like my collaborator Gonzalo is also looking at the moment at r mu nu kind of functions. And as far as the result has obtained so far, one can also write in that particular form. So recently, there was also a paper by Date and Banerjee who looked at, again, in the metric form with generalized Lovelock kind of terms, and their result was also negative. So my belief is that this action can be written as a higher curvature action, but one has to go beyond an metric framework. That's all.
Well, a remark on that. It seems to me that if you look at the Hamiltonian constraint, you know, Willi-Ludwig equation, so you have pi squared plus potential term, which is r plus lambda, then essentially if you were writing instead of pi squared, sinus pi squared, and then reducing, you will get that type of model. Now, to get such a sinus, you know, the thing is that such an Hamiltonian will be highly non-covariant in the sense that you're non-localizing, discretizing the explicit curvature, but not doing the same thing at the level of the intrinsic curvature. So I would not expect that to. So I would expect that to come from some action, but highly non-covariant action.
Yeah.
So action breaking all the symmetry principles that we know.
If you remain in that
theory. Well, it just looks very suggestive as if you expand that in powers of lambda.
It looks very suggestive, but. Like, I've tried very hard and I failed. But maybe somebody else can try to do it. Like,
combining the remarks that Laura made and Param made, sort of seems that one of the things that happens in the connection formulation is precisely that we don't have the potential term and the kinetic terms in the same. But in fact, there's only one term, which is p squared c squared. The two things get together. And that is why, in a Pelletini type of formulation, it may be possible to actually get, as in fact, Param and Gonzalo have shown that it is possible to show to cast it as a curvature invariant, but curvature invariant for the first order form, not for the second order form.
But as Laura points out, if we take pure metric formulation, then it would be very difficult for the reasons that you just said, because we've got two different terms which are competing with each other.
More questions?
I have a last question concerning, in fact, the remark that Abhay made and about the relation with spin foam. So I think this model is interesting for that. But in fact, in the talk, you passed there is a key step here that you made, and you passed very quickly on it, which is the equation for the three. So in spin foam, we are still in the level where all the sums are discrete and all the variables are compact, right? Mm-hmm. But there in this model, because it's like one particle on a circle, you can go to the right hand side of 43 and then decompactify everything. Right? So right. Here you make it look like it's a trivial step, but in fact this is an highly non-trivial step, and it's an highly involved step. This
right, yeah, it definitely is, yeah.
And this is exactly the step that we cannot do in spin form. If we were able to do this step, in some sense maybe we could read out what is the action and, you know. So maybe it would be worth to look into this step more carefully for more complicated models coming out of N3G.
Yeah, that's the thing I was thinking about, exactly what I was thinking about actually this morning is as well as walking in, it how well this step would generalize beyond this type of model and exactly where it'll break down. It must stop working at some point along the way to the full theory, most likely. But yeah, this is a very long involved step.
So I had a question for the spin foam people in the audience, and perhaps Kirill or Laurent. Looking into the future, does one expect that these investigations in homogeneous models will shed light on the issues that spin foam people are worrying about, or are those issues just not well captured in the homogeneous context, like for instance Barrett Crane versus, you know, Friedel Krasnov, etc.?
That's a tough question for the. I don't exactly know for the design. I mean, Barrett-Crane versus other models. I think now we have enough evidence that we know where to look for mainly the semi-classical limit. But the challenge in spin foam is to see whether you could define a projection of the spin foam history, which is like a reduction projection. That would be something. Very useful, and maybe the point we talked about this equation 43, how you go from a discrete sum to a continuous sum. I don't know if the specific models. Interestingly, there is a place in spin form where this equation, an equation of the form H as a constraint, is of the form sine p squared plus minus sine q squared arise. Is in 3D gravity. If you solve this equation, you get it's a direct rule to the Sigrid symbol. So there is a if you solve this equation, but you have six edge lengths, so you have six p's and six q's. You know. So it's an equation that looks like the one in L2G, but I don't know if it's related. That's the usual problem. The problem is to embed maybe these models into the bigger ones, and people should try. I'm not sure I have some.
Okay.
But I have a comment on this thing. I mean, our question actually. Laura, if you just go back to equation 42, right? This is again the question that Jorge was asking just now. So here, there's an effective vertex amplitude, so there's an analog in some heuristic sense at least. And so I thought that one might be able to look at this expression, stare at it more, and really see that this is more analogous to the new models as opposed to the direct train models. I don't know. I mean, I think
I agree. If you could take, let's say, these models and project them in some sensible way so that the boundary variables are just one new, that would be very useful. I'm not sure that people have really tried that very hard so far. So I think it's an interesting question, and people should be encouraged to think about how you can project, you know, these models, and maybe try different projections and see.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't thought too much about. I mean, I thought, you know, it's just hard to think about how you would project, but I don't have any
I didn't thought about it very much, so maybe some other people would have, you know, more insight.
Okay, just as a final, just a totally heuristic comment is that this appearance of Mason function reminded me of the kind of things that Simone and other people were doing, right? I mean, so that these vertex amplitudes might have similar form in some ways, as opposed to the very ultra-local kind of things that one had for the parent train amplitude. So I don't have anything very precise to say, other than saying that just at some very heuristic level, they did look like the vertex amplitude of the more complicated models.
Yeah, that's true.
Any other questions?
Actually, I have a last question just for clarification. So, in equation 43, I would like to understand what is happening, because in the SLQC paper, we also had this condition that the states are symmetric in V. So, I would like to understand, is there something similar condition in this analysis that we have?
We haven't really worried about the fact that the states are symmetric in B here. And this analysis basically, which is done, is roughly is write this sum over nu as an integral over nu with sum of delta functions, and then like manipulate that expression and kind of you can it's somewhat non-trivial and kind of fairly technical to morph it, to kind of map it into this the integrals. The basic idea is take the sum over nu is write it as an integral over a sum of delta functions.
I see. So you are not worrying about that issue right now?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. If there are no more questions, let's thank the speaker again.